Blog Talk Radio. All too often these days, the factory whistle is falling silent in America. But there is a way to get American workers back to work. Start buying more American-made products. Now, a Michigan-based company is leading the way in this movement to strengthen our economy. It's called AmericanMadeProducts.com. AmericanMadeProducts.com is more than a way to purchase American-made products online quickly and securely. It's a way to get our economy moving in the right direction. Go online or call and speak to a live customer service representative. AmericanMadeProducts.com, a family company based on the belief in the American worker and the quality of American-made products. If you're an American manufacturer, big or small, and would like your products on our site, contact us. We add products daily. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your employer about AmericanMadeProducts.com. Visit, shop, and watch America grow. AmericanMadeProducts.com.
All right. How you doing, G?
Pretty good. How you doing, Danny?
Another day.
Yeah. It started off really, really warm. I even put shorts on, and by the time I could get around to get my weed whacker and everything taken care of, it turned cold and started raining.
Oh, you're getting some rain, huh?
Yeah, it started raining. I was like, son of a gun. Well, it's kind of just turned chilly and kind of a drizzle the last couple of hours now.
I think we have Dick on this line. Dick?
Yep.
All right. Almost the gang's here.
Almost.
And where's our buddy Scott at?
I don't know. He might be busy. I don't know.
Well, I haven't really heard of a whole lot going on, have you, Danny?
Well, this the GM tax break I've been reading about the sweetheart deal that they won't have to pay the $45.4 billion in taxes on future profits. That's according to Wall Street Journal and CNN Money. So I've been catching a lot of hell about that. But other than that, I had nothing really going on. How about you, Dick?
No, not really. I've had a lot of people taking up my time the last 3 days on the phone.
Well, I believe it.
It's just people get problems, you know, they come in waves. Some of it has to do with unions, some of it's just friends that need to talk.
Just need to talk, yeah.
Yeah. It's astounding.
Well, I'm glad you're there for them. That's awesome.
Well, I haven't seen much in my morning Google searches on the UAW. There doesn't seem to be much going on.
No. One of the stories I read about is GM's planning on trimming 200 advanced R&D. Now that'd be the research and development jobs and restructuring. And So I read a little bit about that. And it says they'll lay off about 100 of the roughly 400 workers at its advanced R&D unit housed in the Warren Tech Center. And then another 90 R&D people at the GM research facility in India.
Yep.
So they had a little bit of going on about that.
I'm sorry.
Go on, Dick, go on.
They've got 3 tech centers in China now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, they built the one in India. They already had, I think, 1 in China. Then they built, I think, 2 more. Mm-hmm. And now they're consolidating all that. And the tech center has been a ghost town for, I would say, at least 10 years. There's literally nothing going on out there in terms of product development. So all that's being kind of offshored. Although with there's a computer program called CATIA. Actually, it's a computer called CATIA. And it's like when they design these submarines. They can design in 3D, but you have a huge tech center in Australia where General Motors is increasing their resources now for their cars. And then you have the ones in China and the one in India. And, of course, Rüsselsheim from Opel in Germany. And most of the cars there that you're driving now in America were designed in Rüsselsheim 20 years ago. All those platforms, they're mostly Opel platforms. I say Opel, but they're A, B, or whatever C platforms. That was all done in Rüsselsheim. None of that was done in this country. And now, of course, they're increasing their design capacity in Australia. And then they had India and in China. So one has to wonder what they're going to do with that 1 square mile they own in Warren, because the tech center is exactly 1 square mile.
Now, they just took it. That's where a lot of our skilled trades went, was the tech center.
It's a kind of a hideout place, Don.
Oh, is that what it is? I don't know about it.
You can warehouse people out there. I hate to say it that way. But there were people from Pontiac that, when the smoke cleared, when they moved from Pontiac and closed down the one Pontiac operation, a lot of the senior guys went out to the tech center. And so there's a place, by mutual agreement, if a corporation and union want to, you could put trademen out there. But the work, when we had Saturn in 1985, we had a mini tech center in Michigan here at around, it was around 11 mile in I-75. It was an old industrial company that manufactured parts, and Saturn leased this building. It was a good-sized building. And in terms of the product development and building up what they're called as bucks, you build a prototype, they're called a buck.
Okay.
And you build them up for crash testing. You build them, the winter testing grounds for General Motors is up in Campus Casing in northern provinces in Canada. And so we had winter testing in Campus Casing and summer testing in what was then the GM Proving Grounds in Arizona. So you had weather testing in those two places. And then, of course, crash testing we could do at the tech center and the so-called durability testing, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But the total number of trademen we had in that building was only 150 to bring a whole car to market. Because all they really were doing was building up these bucks. I mean, purchasing would purchase parts, and then our tradesmen, what they would do is whatever parts needed to be made up to put the parts together, the connecting parts. The stampings of the body were made somewhere else in GM. So for all practical purposes, that's all we needed was 150, and we probably had more than we needed then. So we had that building at 11 Mile Road, and then we had a 5-story office building at 14 Mile Road in I-75 across from the Oakland Mall, which was then the Saturn World Headquarters. And when I first went to Saturn in late 85, that's where my office was.
Oh, okay.
And Saturn had 2 engineering buildings there across the parking lot, and there were approximately 1,500 people that were working between the headquarters building and the 2 5- or 6-story buildings, which was our engineering center, where we did a lot of the engineering and engineering testing, and we had capacity to do stuff in those buildings. But of those 1,500 people that were working out there, what I found out was that 400 of them were, contract people. And when I went out and started drinking with some of these young, bright engineering types in one of the local bars, I found out some of them had been there for as much as 3 and 3.5 years. And I told Skip LaFoe, the president of Saturn, I said, so this is supposed to be a General Motors car. designed by General Motors people, manufactured by General Motors people, one-third of the people who are here creating this thing are contract workers, and they've been there for some 3, maybe more years. And when I asked them, I said, just sitting around the bar, just doing a little private investigation work with these folks, have none of you ever been offered a job working for General Motors? And I would say 9 out of 10 of the people, at least that I talked to, said, who the hell wants to work for General Motors?
Oh.
All we want, Dick, is 52 hours a week, and we want time off in the wintertime to go skiing or go to the Caribbean. We get our health insurance through the contractor who leases us to General Motors. I said, so you don't ever want to have a career? And 9 out of 10 of them said, heck no. So one of the things that bothered me is they didn't want to work for General Motors, and they were building this car that was going to change the world. And all their primary interest in was the vacation time off and 52 hours a week.
Jesus.
So we had that little complex at 14 Mile, the headquarters building, and across the parking lot, these two big buildings. They're all still there. It's not center anymore. Then out at 11 Mile Road, we had what was essentially our build-up area, which was a plant, a good-sized one, where we actually put together the test vehicles. And that's where typically I was partnered up with the vice president of engineering at that time. So typically I spent about half of my week out there because every Monday morning we would meet in what we called our war room, and we would meet for just about the whole morning. A car has basically 5 systems, just like your assembly plant does. You have chassis, you have interior systems, you have HVAC, you have the powertrain, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Saturn was building its own engine and building its own transmission. And so what we would do all morning is the 5 senior engineers of those 5 body systems would come in, and they would tell us where they were along the progression of the car, and whether or not they changed suppliers or saved any money on the parts and all that kind of stuff. So that's the kind of nature of the work that goes on. But we didn't have the level of computer capacity and global capacity that you have now. And moreover, when you're bringing a car to market, you buy most of the parts from other people. You buy your axles from American Axle. You buy your differentials from Dana. You buy your seats from Lear Johnson Controls. You buy your braking systems from Valeo, who's one of the biggest braking system companies in the world, and they're out of France. And so putting a car together today is kind of like you're buying most of your parts off the shelf, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Because if you put the cars, I think I said this last week, if you put 20 cars behind a big white sheet and put a light behind them and you had to sit out in the auditorium and look at them, you wouldn't be able to pick out one car from the other. The silhouettes are all the same. The glass shapes are all the same. And that's because the suppliers only make certain configurations. They make some bigger, some smaller. But if you really look at those things, they all kind of tend to look the same, don't they?
Yes.
Because you're buying commoditized parts. So all that engineering stuff is long gone from, I think the last real effort that General Motors made to actually bring its own product to market was the Saturn.
Wow.
And I know when I was in sourcing, corporate sourcing, Russelsheim was really, they were in the throes of creating all these platforms that you see under all your cars today. And, of course, now Fiat's going to be supplying that to Chrysler for their new cars. So
yeah.
It's interesting what's going on with the global automobile industry. And then you see these mergers of people. I just saw on the Internet where somebody's going to use somebody else's engine and transmission now. Global car company is going to use another one's engine and transmission. So sooner or later, these cars, they're getting like homogenized milk. And sooner or later, there isn't going to be that much difference in the brand itself. There's not that much difference now, probably.
Seems like it's going to be a lot closer. You're right. I heard about some of that.
I think the biggest difference is probably in the trucks right now. Although, if you look at the Toyota Tundra, I mean, if you looked at it in a silhouette, it looks just like a damn Dodge.
Yeah.
When they brought out their big truck. And so you do see a difference, though, between Ford and Chrysler and GM. I don't know about all the undercarriage parts, how much commonality there is, but you can basically tell the difference between a Ford, a Dodge, and a GM truck. The cars are another story.
Yeah, cars are different. Trucks you can tell.
Cars are the same. Trucks are different, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
It's like when you watch a NASCAR race, they all look identical. They all have different paint colors, and you have to look real close to see which emblem is on the front of it to find out what make the car is. They're all identical.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Same
interesting
skin.
Interesting what's going on. I just still believe that at some point, I mean, you have Chrysler and Fiat who have become one company now. And Fiat is hell-bent for leather to own all the stock in Chrysler. And one of the sad parts about Chrysler, for all the cost cutting and all the alternative work schedules and all the high overtime and all this other stuff, the American workers' profit sharing dollars are keeping Fiat afloat. And I think that's why these profit sharing checks have gone global now. Because you get your profit sharing based on General Motors' global performance, right?
Well, I think it's North American.
Oh, that's right. Ours is North America. I thought it was global. But in any event, point is, though, it's like General Motors wants to put probably the better part of $500 million into Germany. Well, I think I read something that I found somewhere that North America now has become the profit center for the global automobile industry, especially where you have these companies that there's a guy named Kenichi Ohama who wrote a book in 1983 called The Mind of the Strategist, and he said that in order for a car company or any company on the planet, they would have to have a presence in the North and South American continent, in the European and African continent, and in Asia, the three basic parts of the world. And you're seeing that happen now to where they're like that. The problem is that General Motors has their presence with Opel, and it's going to cost something no less than $350 million and could go up to, $500 million.
Jeez.
But where's that money going to come from? It comes from you. It comes from the profit that you folks and your plan generate.
Yeah, you're right. I can see that. I'm going to get 342. I'm going to get you on right now. So you're on. You can join. At least I think you want it to. 342. Maybe not. I'll put you back on hold.
Did anybody look at the 10Q that General Motors filed at all?
I haven't. Jeannie?
No, I haven't either. I kind of scanned the title of it, but I haven't had time to go into reading more on it. What have you heard about it, Dick?
Well, I didn't hear anything about it. I pulled it off the internet and read it.
Okay.
I think there's some pension problems. Although, let me ask you something. Have you heard anything from any any Tier 2 workers at all about getting a pension fiduciary letter from the corporation?
I have heard of none.
No, I haven't.
Well, they got them in Lordstown. And I think maybe that General Motors is getting ready. They only mailed them to the Tier 2 workers. And that was that business of, remember when they got the letter before, they said they were closing down the pension plan, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Well, in order to de-risk, the consultants who sell de-risking programs say that the best way to do it is to first close down your pension plan and then convert people to defined contribution or cash balance plans and get them away from defined benefit plans. And they sent letters out to the Tier 2s. The letters were sent to the Tier 2s, but there's nothing in there that says it only applies to the Tier 2s. And what they're saying is that the company has the right to convert their pensions to annuities. I think I said once or twice before that de-risking is taking an existing pension and annuitizing it. So they got these letters, and the language in these letters talks about the fact that the corporation can simply create an annuity out of their pensions, because de-risking is fundamentally about getting the pension off the books of General Motors, much like they do the VEBA. Okay, I mean, there's a good metaphor there. They create a VEBA to get the health care off their books. Well, the way you get the pensions off your books is you create these annuities through this de-risking process. And so those letters have already gone out to people in Lordstown talking about doing that. But there's nothing in there that says it only applies to Tier 2 people. So it could apply, let's say, to active workers. There's nothing that says it doesn't. And I think I told you they were waiting for some rules changes from Washington. Some did show up in a Federal Register a few months ago, but they were proposed changes, and I talked about this word bifurcation.
Right.
We may be seeing the opening act of this hourly de-risking.
Well, that's what it sounds like.
I don't know, because they've been strangely quiet. I mean, I said last week they made all this noise about the big deal about the contract would be de-risking the pension, and the only people they screwed around with is the salaried people. And, of course, Ford did that last week. They did all their salaried people. But there's no mention of hourly, and I'm just thinking, much like when they had to go to Washington and get a rules change against prohibitive illegal activities to fund your pension with stock because it was against the law. I'm thinking they're probably in a process of rules changes, and right now they're dealing with some of these Tier 2s or probably people who had less than 5 years, and it's 5 years, isn't it, Don, to get vested?
I know it's 10.
Now it's 10.
Yeah.
Okay, but there could be people in the plants. I shouldn't have said Tier 2. There could be people in the plants who aren't fully vested, but who have are covered by ERISA because money's been put into their pension account, and they're active workers in the plant.
Yeah.
And I think this is what that letter goes to, the people who aren't vested. Because once you're vested, they can't screw around with that. If they wanted to change you over to a defined contribution, that's fine. They've already closed down your pension plan.
Mm-hmm.
So if they want to convert you to defined contribution now, they could do that. and then that would lessen the amount of pension accrual that you have accruing in your defined benefit plan. I know a reporter that's what one of the newspapers in town did with all their reporters. They just close it down, then they say, okay, now we're going to convert you to defined contributions. So whatever you've got in your defined contribution at the point in time that we convert you, that's what you're going to get covered by ERISA in that way. And now you're going to be in a defined contribution.
And that gets you off the books and...
No.
It doesn't get off? Okay.
Well, what it does is it stops you accruing. It precludes any more accrual of liability. That's what that does.
All right. You stay on the books, but then you stop earning. I see what you're talking about.
You don't add another pension benefit year right. in and year out.
Right.
Right now, they have frozen your pension plan, but you're still in it. So every year that goes by, you're still accruing another, let's say, $54 per month per year, right?
Right.
Okay, now, that's where all the liability is. Now, the 10Q says they've got in their plans collectively some $26 or $27 billion of underfunding right now. Now, that's in all the plans. And if I remember right, during negotiations, somebody let slip that the number that General Motors was using for their unfunded liability, two-thirds of that was UAW underfunding. So I'm going to take that number and go with $27 billion and say that the UAW plan is $18 billion underfunded. The part that goes to the UAW.
Right.
So, but every year, though, there's however many of you there are out there, you're still adding $54 per month per year. So if they now say we're going to do what we do with the salaried people and we're going to take you out of the defined benefit process and put you in the defined contribution process, now what that would mean is the committee is defined in Appendix A of the contract, where they talked about that pension stuff, you know, where they're coming up with, the parties will come up with a new plan for certain existing retirees.
Right.
What they do with the salaried people, they simply say, you're not accruing anymore. You're not losing anything that you got. We're going to put you in a defined contribution. Now, they may or may not give you a match. This friend of mine... The way it works with him is if he doesn't contribute anything to it, they put, I think it's 4% of his pay in. If he puts 4% in, they put another 4% in. So he gets a total of 12% per month going into his defined contribution plan, yet he only contributes 4%. Now, that's just an example. I don't know what the UAW would what they'll work out with the committee. Now, it's not that the UAW has any real legislative veto power over what General Motors does with its pensions.
Mm-hmm.
But you have this committee that's defined in the first 12 pages of Appendix A. And what the union does is become complicit that no one, because the union represents us all, it means you're not going to go to federal court and sue them.
Right.
Because you, for all purposes, they're saying for legal purposes, you were at the table. So if they, say, took you and said you're going to be in defined contribution, then they could say, well, you can put, like, you can put what in your paid personal savings, 10%, something like that. You can actually put more if you want to, though, can't you?
I don't know what the number is. Maybe Scott, if once I get... Scott, do you know?
Well, whatever the case may be. So if you put... They could well say, you put so much in, we'll put so much in. We'll put so much in, you don't have to put anything in. If you put something in, we'll match that, too. That's what they did with him. But there's all kinds of ways they can do that. But what happens is now is that $18 billion liability stops growing, doesn't it?
Right.
So now, rather than have to put money in, they can just wait for everybody to die.
Yeah.
Right?
That's it.
And go with the defined contribution. So I'm just thinking that it's been quite a while now since the contract. They said they wanted to de-risk. Actually, I talked to a reporter about that last week. I said, what are you guys all sleeping? Why aren't you guys writing? Where's the story here about the hourly pension plans? What are they doing with them? And then the 10Q comes out, and they say, well, our overall plans are 27-plus underfunded. And, of course, the IRS, who's the policeman of pension plans, has got to be saying, you guys got to do something, because General Motors plans are not funded to minimum ERISA requirement right now. So there's this, all these things on the kitchen counter that in some sequence go into this pot to make this stew about de-risking. And I think we're seeing little parts and pieces of things that are going into that pot show up.
Yeah, it sounds like. Scott, I think you're on right now.
Well, hello, everybody.
Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Don. Hi, Dick.
Hi there.
Hey, sorry I'm late. Yeah, I was listening to Dick talk about that, you know, and for once I get to say this. Dick, I think you were being a little easy on him. De-risk.
On who?
On the UAW. Think about it. Now, we're talking about de-risking. De-risking hell. They come right out and they told us in the national contract, at any point that we feel that the company is not being viable because of our pensions, they're going to open up the contract. I mean, how much more blatant can we understand? If they get a chance to take more away from us, they're not going to match nothing. They're going to take away.
Well, you got a problem there, Scott. They've got $31 billion in liquid assets right now, and they got a credit line of some almost $30 billion they can draw on.
Right.
The pension plan is not putting them at risk. Okay.
If
they didn't have any real cash in the bank, and if they didn't have any line of credit, then you could do what I think it was American Airlines is saying. Well, we're going to have to file bankruptcy. We're going to get rid of the pension plans, put them with the pension guarantee board, and then we're going to go on with our business. But General Motors, number one, doesn't dare start talking about filing bankruptcy.
No.
I mean, no one will ever buy another General Motors car again.
Right.
And the other thing is they have cash. If you look at the 10Q, if you look at the slides are available. I mean, folks, you don't have to read the 342 pages of the 10Q. There's a 27-page slide presentation you can pull off the GM website.
Correct.
And it's basically charts and Pareto bars. And you can get a really good look at what's going on with General Motors. They're financially, right now, not in harm's way. Wall Street's concerned because they're not growing their market share. They're doing really bad in terms of growing market share. The only thing that's saving them right now is that the market's getting bigger. But they're still not keeping their market share. And they said they made $1 billion in the first quarter, but whether they made $1 billion or not, some people are questioning that because they could have just augmented their bottom line with some of their excess cash. One would have to sit down and really do some numbers in terms of North American revenue and number of vehicles sold and divide that out to see how much actual money they're making per vehicle.
And the, what was the word I used, the gratuitous? The write-off.
You gotta figure out what that means. You could probably Google that word, or you could go to FASB Google FASB and look for a FASB dictionary as to what gratuitous amounts are. You know, it's like Black's Law Dictionary. If you look up a word in Black's Law Dictionary, it may have a different meaning than what you're going to find in Webster.
Correct.
And the same thing when you look in a financial dictionary in terms of the terms they use in a financial statement, what are the things that comprise gratuitous?
Do you know what we're talking about, Don, right now?
Not really.
Okay, what happened was the Thursday morning they announced the profits for the first quarter.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If you look into some of this stuff, they said there's a – I asked Dick about this. It was Friday. I talked to Dick for a little while about all these different numbers. I said, look, somebody put out this number. Somebody put out this number. And then you talk to Mark Royce, the vice president for General Motors, made a statement. He used a third set of numbers. So I was confused. So I called Dick. I says, what's up with all these numbers? He says, well, it depends which answer do you want. And he says, because every set of numbers is going to have a different question, a different answer. And that's what I was asking him.
Yeah.
And I says, what about this gratuitous thing here? And he says, what happened was, is what Mark Royce said, they wrote off, I think, was it 660 or 650 million for Europe? Or was it Spain?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
for
and
Europe?
They call that gratuitous. Gratuitous expense.
Yeah, and they're doing those write-offs and money they owed people in the back, and they're paying that. Well, that came out of the profit. Just like the stuff they're doing right now in China, in Mexico, in Thailand. Where
mm-hmm.
do you think that money's coming from? That's coming out of our profits.
Well, the other thing I think I told you last year to watch, they had something like 38, at the end of 2011, didn't they have $38 billion?
Yeah, 37.6, I think.
Yeah.
Now they're saying they got. Now they're saying they got 33.
Right.
In terms of free cash flow, in terms of assets and liquidity, $5 billion has disappeared somewhere. Now that was the same money they called Fortress GM financing, and what they said in October of 2011. We have this $38 billion, but we're not going to use that for contract negotiations or anything else. And you and I had a conversation. I said, so Bob King had to agree that he couldn't say, okay, you got $38 billion in the bank, let's restore COLA. They came out and said publicly that that money was in GM Fortress Finance, and it would not be used for negotiations or one other thing. I can't remember what the other thing is.
For shareholders. That's not the shareholder
for shareholders. For shareholders and negotiations.
Yeah.
Now they turned around, they filed their 10-Q at the end of the year, and they had all of a sudden $600 million had disappeared out of that cash hoard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then $600 million turns up in gratuitous charge-offs to Europe. But that money wasn't supposed to be used for that. And that cash hoard, if you go back and look at the end of the year or third quarter of 2011 and look at their cash in the liquid assets and look at it what it is in the first quarter this year, there's some multiples of billions of dollars missing. And then you have to go wandering around, and as you said, there, when they present these slides and you look at them, you'll find those different perspectives in the slides. You'll find them more so in the 342 pages. But in the slides, it's easy enough to see because you'll see something. You say, okay, now I know what the amount is attached to those words. And three slides later, you see those words with a different piece of money attached to it. And then you have to go look at the footnotes. But it really doesn't matter for all practical purposes. What I'm saying is they are using that cash hoard. And nobody wants to pick up on that. But they're still not anywhere near saying they have to file bankruptcy because the workers cost too much. I mean, my God, when you look at what's going on at Chrysler, GM, and Ford.
Just
since the contracts have been ratified. You guys are working, you're producing per capita way more revenue than you were when the contract was signed. With the harvesting of the workforce, with the way work is being moved around, you're constantly producing more and more wealth for the corporation, whether you're in Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Chrysler is implementing alternative work schedules with a vengeance. They're not asking, they're telling. And I said last week on the program at Spring Hill, when that assembly operation goes up, the work schedules and the overtime distribution is going to be negotiated between the international union and the corporation. The local union is going to have nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. And that's in black letter print. And that's where they're going to make their money.
Yes.
So you guys just keep producing more and more wealth, and it's not really benefiting you at all. I mean, and then they turn around, and General Motors says, well, we want to keep Opel. So there's $650 million. It isn't going to be in the profit sharing for the quarter, right?
Correct.
And now Marsha, they say, well, we did $1 billion. Well, you can easily move $1 billion out of the 30-some billion-dollar cash hoard.
I'm sure you can.
So if you want to talk about gratuitous, my sense is they said, well, we're going to show $1 billion, okay, because we can't
yeah.
be making Bob King look like a moron and say that, you know, they're not making money. So it's very easy
right.
for them to throw $1 billion around in General Motors right now. The gross revenues was maybe a couple $1 billion less in the first quarter of this year than it was in the first quarter of last year, but the profit sure as hell is a whole lot less.
Right. And the profits didn't come
the
much
EBITDA,
off North
I'm talking
America.
About the EBITDA profit.
Right. The profits didn't come much off of North America as much as it did China. And then the ones that did come off of North America was the small car sales. All you have to do is follow the sales a little bit.
Well, trucks were your money maker in North America,
right? But the light duty or the small vehicles, the Sonic and the Cruise, are the ones that had the huge double digit increases in sales.
Well, I don't know how huge the Cruise sales were when you look at the best selling vehicle list and see how far down the Cruise list is. The Cruise is on
list. I see what you're saying. I'm just talking as
far
as
General
Motors.
See, that's what I'm talking about. Your EBITDA profit that's going to determine your profit share, really there's a direct link between that and market share, not
right.
number of cars. They sold numbers of cars, but they lost market share.
Right, but
actually,
the EBITDA was $2.2
billion. Across the board, General Motors came up, if you do the highs and the lows, with zero gain. Although
right.
they're saying in cars, General Motors' market share in the first quarter is only 16.2% now, just in cars.
Right.
So when I say it's zero, that means averages the highs and lows. But when you look at cars, they're not doing well at all. It's only 16.2%.
Right.
And that's what Wall Street's concerned about. That's why the stock isn't going anywhere. You know, people are already writing in the Wall Street Journal and some other papers about what's going on with General Motors. Where's the big recovery for the corporation? I mean, to hear Ackerson and Mark Royce talk, well, we're really on a roll. Well, the other people are saying, no, you ain't on a roll. Where is the roll?
Yeah.
Where is
yeah.
it?
There was a lady, I cannot think of her name, she wrote for the Wall Street Journal, and
Sharon
she talked
Phillip,
about,
I think.
And she talked about, she had mentioned Ackerson's, I'm sorry, I'm not a business person, so it's asinine to me.
That was
comment
either
about,
Clarissa Priddle or that was Sharon Turlip, yeah, that talked, she was talking about, where is it, where's
well,
this big
what
blossoming?
She said, Well, what she was, what her point was, is she had put that quote, that S9 quote that Ackerson said, it's not about market share, it's all about profit. And then what she did was she ran on that thought, because we all agree that he's a hedge fund manager, and that's how he thinks. And you and I know that in the auto industry, it's all about market share. It's not about the profit. But what she did write was how the profit of General Motors vehicles has went up 20-some percent over last year. And what she wrote in the article was, if you're not selling the vehicles and the profit's up, so she said they've raised the prices on the vehicles.
So the bottom line. Prices up.
Right. And she goes, they're not making as many as they say they are. And she had a number in there. And our production, General Motors say the production is up from last year. But if you talk to her, she give you some numbers, and the production was actually down. We're making more money on less vehicles. That means that the cost of the vehicles has went up. And she put an average on, and the average price was like 22% across the board on all the vehicles.
Well, you're talking about overall balance sheet now.
Right, but what she said, though, is if you have all these people, she said, and she did mention that in this article, that General Motors is below 50,000 hourly employees, and if you've raised the price on all the vehicles at an average of 22% across the board on all the vehicles that General Motors makes, she was saying they should have made a lot more money, I guess is what the article was saying.
Well, that's because Ackerson was like Royce, throwing numbers around that have nothing to do with the conversation he was having.
Right.
That's the problem with this financial discourse that goes on. But the General Motors is the market leader right now in one area. General Motors is making more subprime car loans than anybody else in the country.
Oh, boy.
And Wall Street is already decrying that, the General Motors is I'm not going to say this was in the article, but they are now increasing the risk to the corporation with this.
Right, I heard that.
I think General Motors is 8.6% subprime loans in the first quarter, and the closest one to them is 6.1.
Jesus. Never.
Yeah.
So you got all these little parts and pieces of the company out there. Truth About Cars actually put a thing in about their first quarter statement, and there used to be a guy named Bob Farago who wrote for them, and he, going into the bankruptcy, he did a series of articles for 6 months called the General Motors Death Watch, and they were just brilliant, comprehensive pieces on all the parts and pieces of the corporation. And then he also did a series called the Chrysler Death Watch and the Ford Death Watch. I don't know how the hell this guy, coming out of one brain, put all this data together so marvelously. Now, he doesn't work there anymore, and they don't do as good a job anymore at this site. But this one guy, his name is Bertel Schmidt, and he wrote a piece on the first quarter statement. He says, well, we're not saying it's time for a GM death watch just yet. I don't want to be a complete pessimist, but I think it is time for a GM death watch right now. I think it is time to take the kind of conversation that we're having tonight and really get some professional forensic accountants in to tell the real picture of what's going on in GM. I really believe it's time. Because I don't believe that they're in a position to help themselves anymore. And I believe maybe if somebody gets out and tells the real truth of their numbers, that might make a difference. Then, of course, you'll have Obama saying, oh, no, you can't do that. Nobody will buy the GM cars. The stock will go down.
Well, but, by the way, what did GM stock close at Friday? I forgot to see. It was down below $20.
22-something, I think, Scott. 22.37, something like that.
Well, I'm just...
Well, I mean,
if we look at this, the information they give us, and we talk about the pensions, I still believe if there's a way, And I don't care because there is no feelings for us. I think if there's any way that they can find a way to take more away from us, they'll do it. With Bob,
they're doing it now. That's what I just got done saying. They're doing it with these changes in work schedules.
Right. And I think as the national contract says, if they can say, no matter if they're making money or not, you know as well as I do, if they can go to a federal court or go to Bob King and say, look, we're just not making enough here. We're not hitting the numbers we need. Okay, but nobody's going to say, but are you still making money? Well, yeah, but that's besides the point. We want to make more money. And if
well,
we can do that
you
off
need,
the,
you need as insane a judge as they would be for asking.
And they've got them. You know as well as I do, they do.
Yeah.
And that's my point on the thing with the pensions. Believe me, if they can find a way to put the screws to Jeannie and Donnie and myself and the rest of the tier one, the upper legacy workers, they'll do it.
Well, there's 18.
I mean,
let me just say this: buried in the 10Q. Does anybody know how many skilled tradesmen retired from when they first offered that SAP in September or October when a contract was passed in the end of the first quarter? You want to know how many skilled tradesmen actually retired?
Yeah, I'd like to know.
1,400.
Wow.
And they wanted how many thousands?
And they're saying that they spent $99 million to get them to retire. That figures out to an average of about $70,000-some-odd. Don't forget, that's the whole cost. That's not somebody gave you a brown bag full of money with $70,000 in it. But they're saying 1,400 people took the special attrition program, and the cost of the corporation was $99 million. So you had 48,500 hourly workers going into negotiations. 12,000 were skilled tradesmen. Of the 48,000 people who worked for General Motors, 18,000 could retire. Of the 18,000 that could retire, 6,000 were skilled tradesmen. And of the 6,000 who were eligible to retire, 1,400 from last September to now have taken a retirement at a cost of $99 million.
Which came out of our profit.
Came out of the pension plan.
The pension plan.
Right.
Came out of the pension plan. Those incentives, those car vouchers, should not be coming out of the pension plan.
I agree.
Nor should the supplement on the 30 and out be coming out of the pension plan.
There you go. There's a conversation. Want to help de-risk the pension plan? Quit paying all the vouchers and the SAP out of the pension plan. That'll help it, won't it?
Help it a lot, because not only can we not find out how many pension checks do they mail out to UAW people every month, you can't find that out, nor can you find out what the total amount per month is that gets mailed out, nor could you find out a breakout number of how many of those pension checks that they mail out go to 30 and out people, and how much of those pension checks are total supplement money and how much are ERISA-based pension money.
Right. Right.
But you're right about what they're doing. I mean, and the thing was, if you remember, Ackerson said he wanted the quarterly profits to be 10% per quarter. And I don't think they made 10% yet, but I think the way they've cooked their books, that they got it up, I think they got 6 points something at the end of the year last year. And I think in this quarter, by whatever bookkeeping process they've got, I think it was something like 8-something percent. But then it was only $1 billion.
And what they say Wednesday? They said the car sales were down 8%, or the overall sales were down 8% from the same time last year, which we know how that
You're talking about General
out.
Motors, though.
Yes, General Motors. And
nobody
now,
else's sales are down, just General Motors. Well, Ford has joined the bandwagon with, somebody wrote about that. All of a sudden, Ford has joined the GM bandwagon of less sales per quarter.
Right.
Quarter to quarter.
But then when you look at on Wednesday, they said the sales were down overall 8%, but the Sonic sales were up 43%. Cruise sales were up like 20%. Those are the two that were doing it. The Cadillac had increased like 1%, not
yeah,
a whole
Scott,
lot.
Scott, those percentages are not attached to big numbers.
I agree.
I mean, you take Bentley sales are up something like, I don't know, what, 400%?
Right.
They sold 127.
Right. That's what you're saying.
That's the same kind of talk that upset you when Royce was throwing numbers around.
Yeah. Yeah.
That month-to-month over sales, you know, Sonic sales are up 20%. Well, how many is that? What was the plan at Sonic? I know what the plan at Saturn was. 3,500 people make 350,000 cars a year with no overtime. What was the plan at Saturn? What was the business model? When they started production, how many Sonics were they going to make and sell in a year? Not what percent of increased sales quarter over quarter. Let's face it. The third quarter of last year to this quarter this year, Sonic sales are up 20%. That's not saying very much. Well, we both know that their first-time quality off the assembly line might have been marginally 50%.
Correct.
So the point is, and we had this conversation, I thought that they would bring the Sonic out to be like a Volkswagen, a people's car, an affordable vehicle that everybody could buy with a set price. Instead of that, now you can take a $16,000 Sonic and pay $26,000 for it.
Yeah. I think the Cruise starts out at, what, 18? And you can take it all the way up to 30.
Yeah.
That was
the same thing that got him into trouble in the first place.
Yep.
That kind of stuff.
What was the, was it the, I'm trying to think, 27, 23, was it the 97 contract? 98 contract. 99 contract. That they said that they were going to lower the price on the vehicles. And they never did from that point on. They never did lower the price on the vehicles. They did 1 year. They kept the prices the same on the next year model. And from that point on, we've never done that. The price keeps going up every year. We're being
and who are they blaming it
left.
On now? I mean, if you take
sure
the and you can't take 48,000 people in General Motors. General Motors has 14 assembly plants. Okay,
right.
All right. How many clipboarders are in those 14 plants?
A lot.
No less than 1,000. No less
right.
than 1,000. Moreover, those people don't work 40 hours, do they?
No, they work more.
Okay. So if you were going to say worker to vehicle, how many workers are producing how many vehicles?
Let's take
a minimum of at least 1,200 people, because other plants also have clipboarders.
Sure.
Let's take 1,200 people out of the workforce, subtract them from the workforce, and here's another thing that I was talking to a reporter about. I said, how come nobody knows how many people work at Ford, GM, or Chrysler anymore, and Ford, GM, and Chrysler don't want to talk about it? They couldn't talk about the number of people they had enough in September of 2011. Now
right.
they didn't want to talk about how many people work in a plant. So we have no way to know how many are in there. But if we take the old number of, and Turlip is saying, well, they got 50,000 people. I got to tell you, I doubt that.
So do I. And
when you look at the harvesting of the workforce that went on across the board in General Motors, across the board last year, late last year, and you look at what is going on in the plants today,
I would doubt they even have the 48,500 they said they had going into the contract. But even if they did, if we take 1,200 away from that, and then we take two people for every 250 people, which are committeemen and alternates, out of that, and we take one person for every 275 people, which are Doc 46, out of that, we have
right. Maybe
a couple thousand people who we can't count because they don't
right. Do
anything.
And to make that number even look a little bit better, I have to understand how many of these people are tier two pay raise or pay wage that help lessen the impact of those people. You know what I'm saying?
You know what, Scott? See, don't get caught up in that. That's a different conversation.
Right. What I'm saying is
that's a conversation about labor cost, not productivity.
What I'm saying is labor cost. Think about it.
Productivity.
No, but if they say we have, you know, this many people working, right? I see what you're saying. I'm productivity. You're right. You only have
so
many people.
There are two different. See, that's what you
yes. Could.
You could use numbers. If you had a conversation and you mixed up labor costs with productivity, which is you're doing with what you're doing to me now.
Right.
Then people who don't understand this get all screwed around. Productivity is how many workers produce either if you take the number of hourly workers, take the number of salaried workers, remove and figure out the ratio, how many salaried workers to hourly workers, and then divide that into the $139 billion they made in the quarter.
Right.
That would show you, removing, of course, the non-value-added people, the committee people, the Doc 46 people, the special assigned people. That then would give you the dollars of wealth that an individual worker produced, whether he be a $33 an hour tradesman or a $15 an hour temporary. Doesn't matter. They're doing work. So how much wealth? And then to go to your issue, well, if you're costing him $29 an hour and his temporaries cost him $16, then they're really getting a big bargain for the $16 an hour guy because he's producing as much wealth as you are, only you're costing more. That's the point you were trying to make. But that's in terms of that is a labor cost thing. I'm just talking warm bodies. I'm saying $46,000 maybe hourly guys generate $138 billion in revenue minus the ratio between the number of salaried and the number of hourly, and you're creating ever more wealth. So if you track that number every quarter, you're going to find that you're producing more and more dollars of revenue with less and less people. Never mind the number of cars. That's a different conversation. See where I'm coming from?
That's why
when you look at those slide presentations, they have these kinds of pictures about the same subject.
Right.
So it's how many cars per worker, how many dollars of gross revenue. If Scott Shingledecker produced X number of dollars in the first quarter, and then we take the profit they're declaring for North America and calling that, what, $1 billion?
Right.
EBITDA?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Then you divide that by the number of hourly workers, and that you created this many dollars in revenue, and you only created this many dollars in profit. And if you track those two numbers quarter to quarter, you get a better picture of what's really going on in terms of the people who work in the plant, in terms of redistribution of wealth, in terms of working harder, not smarter, in terms of throwing away a fair day's work for a fair day's pay. But more, my favorite creature on earth
who likes to run around yipping and yapping about a fair wage.
Bob King.
What's going to be fair about that? Because you're creating more and more wealth for the corporation, and you're going to find you're creating less and less profit that you share in.
Yes.
And that, and regardless of the dollar amount of an hour, that's not a fair wage. Because you're not, what did Bob King say? Want everybody to share in the wealth, right?
Right.
Well, hello, it only took them 2 years to figure out not to let you how to do that. Not the real wealth you're creating. The real wealth is your quarterly revenue. That's the wealth. When Bob King says wealth, that's the wealth. That's the wealth that's meaningful to you as an hourly worker in a plant. So you look at 300 and some pages of the 10Q or 8K, called, you know, they're two different things, but they are the same thing. You look at the 27 pages of slides, and let me tell you, I don't know how much money it costs them to put that obfuscation in those 27 pages, but they do a pretty damn good job of it.
Uh-huh. It's a never-ending story.
Well, it's like you and I had the conversation. The first 100 years was the apprenticeship, and I had every hope when they came out of bankruptcy, that was their graduation ceremony, and they became a journeyman car-making company instead of just starting a second-year, 100-year apprenticeship. But it looks like we're well on our way to the second 100-year apprenticeship here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Donnie, Jeannie,
because they're
they can...
doing the same things they did before. Nothing's really changed.
That's
what's
what
really
say.
Changed, though, is your economic status in our society. Of all the hourly workers, especially the legacy workers, it's you folks' economic status has changed. It just keeps, like I said, you keep getting poorer every month. They publish the CPI, you get poorer.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Yep, yep.
And this has been going on since 2005, don't forget.
Right.
I got to take a look at one of those CPI calculators now and see what your $29 and change is worth today in terms of if I put in $28 an hour from 2005 and put in 2012, then it'll tell me how many dollars you need today to buy what that $28 bought you in 2005.
The
last
time I
checked, you needed $34.
I was going to say, we had to be around $33 to $35.
You were about $34, and that was last year when I checked. But then, just in March alone, the CPI went up 0.3%. So you're 0.3% poorer for March.
Right.
Just standing doing nothing. You just get poorer every time that CPI goes up. Even if it's 1/10, it doesn't matter. It diminishes your buying power.
Absolutely.
And that's what the UAW has not taken on at the bargaining table. They've taken away all the safety nets, the 3% AIFs, the COLA. They've taken all that away. And you know, you can't say, if COLA is going to be a flat rate, then fine, give me a pension or give me a lump sum or give me a profit-sharing check if COLA is going to be a lump sum. But COLA's not.
No, COLA's out of the equation.
Variable is a variable multiplier.
And I'm sure we're far from screaming yet. I think it's going to get a hell of a lot worse before it gets better.
Well, you know, I don't know that it's going to get drastically worse, Don.
Okay.
It's the frog in the pot kind of thing. I mean, it's just that every month you just have less and less buying power with the money that you make.
Right.
It's like Dave Yautau used to say, narcotize them with overtime, and they'll never understand how much they're really making. And he said that 20-some years ago to Steve Jokic at the GM Council meeting. And he's right.
And Dave was right.
And the point is, you know, you are in one, you guys who are legacy workers on one socioeconomic strata. The people who are making $16 an hour are in another socioeconomic strata. You know, there are, I was talking to Scott, there's a woman who got a grant from Germany who wants to do a documentary, and a friend of mine asked me to talk with her and help her. She's a prize-winning documentary director. She works, actually, she works for the U.S. government. She works for Bureau of Labor Statistics. But she's German, her family's from Germany, and she made a documentary in 2009. It won all these prestigious awards in Europe. And now she's got a grant from Germany to make a documentary on the impact of what's going on in the auto industry on American workers. And she's looking for four families that she can do a not a one-time interview, but spend time with each of the four families and their friends and interview them all and show what the impact of plant closings, possible layoffs, and those kinds of things have meant to people. And what I'm saying is that one of the things I told her is there were people who work at Orion who are working in a UAW plant who tentatively are going to get a contract, but that's been going on for a year now.
Mm-hmm.
But they pay dues, they make $9 an hour, and then they have to go in and go to work at Orion, and then they have to leave real quick so they can go to their other full-time job. These are workers working in a GM plant who have two full-time jobs because they can't make ends meet. And when I was talking to Scott, he told me he knew a couple people in your plant.
Yeah.
He went from temporary to tier two, and they kept their other full-time job.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know a couple.
Now,
one.
If that is not a story, I don't know what is.
That's right.
Especially when you look at all the rhetoric that Bob King sprued out there.
Oh, my God.
In September and October of 2011. What in God's name are UAW dues-paying members who are not temporary, who are working full-time, having to have another full-time job, just so they can survive on a planet Earth doing inside these plants?
That's right.
If that is a fair wage,
that.
I need some help.
He's still going around saying that crap.
I know he is.
And it just makes me sick to my goddamn stomach. Every time I see a picture of him, I want to punch my TV out.
Well, I'm trying to get some interest. I don't know what this woman, I haven't had a chance to have another conversation with her. I don't think she knows that much about our world. I've been sending her some things, and I sent her an email and said, you know, I don't really think you understand our world. And so I've been sending her stuff to try and help her understand it. There's a marvelous piece, I don't know if you saw it, about Caterpillar. Did you see that piece, Don?
I've seen a few things on Caterpillar.
No, it was written by a guy named David McCrary.
I don't
remember reading something by a guy like that.
I don't know who wrote the articles I read.
But does that name sound familiar with you?
Yes, it does. It does sound familiar.
Well, he wrote an article about Caterpillar, and he uses a metaphor called price. He uses price gouging.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Gotcha.
And so he goes on to say, you know, when there are hurricanes or tornadoes that go through, it's against the federal law for merchants in the area to price gouge. And he used the thing like if a gallon of water costs a dollar before the hurricane or a tornado came through, how come the store is selling it for $5 the next day? And so they made a federal law and said you can't price gouge where there are areas where there are disasters.
Right.
And he goes on to take that metaphor and convert it into an article that says, well, there's a disaster in the workplaces of America. But he's more familiar with Caterpillar, and he says the Caterpillar has turned around to their people in Peoria, and they want these draconian concessions now. And he says, but there's no storm for Caterpillar.
Caterpillar's making money hand over fist right now.
Huge.
And yet they're turning around now, and they're saying to them, we need concessions.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of saying, so, well, these are not his words. He's
right.
saying essentially, so where is the social justice here? They're doing it because they can. That's why they're doing it.
Yes.
And don't forget, Caterpillar is a UAW plant.
Right.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, nowhere in this article is Bob King mentioned.
Yeah.
Or I believe Jimmy Settles has got egg him.
Yeah.
But none of the shooters at Solidarity House were mentioned, right?
Yeah.
And he's writing the article and says they do it because they can. And they can because there's no union between these workers and that corporation. That's why they can.
Damn.
Well, you know, if you stop and look at Caterpillar. Caterpillar, if you watch Caterpillar on the Dow Jones, I try looking at him at least once a week since last fall, has steadily went up every week. They're going up. That kind of enlightened me as to why their sales are doing so well, because they make this specialized, like an earth mover, I guess.
Not just that, Scott.
China alone
could consume all of Caterpillar's output for the next 10 years.
Right, right.
China alone.
But there's a, what's the special tool that they use up in Canada? Is that to get the oil sand?
They've got these huge haulers now because, you know, you have to dig this stuff out of the ground, then you have to move it from where you, like an iron ore mine, where they got these huge trucks, you know, where the tires are, what?
Right, and they're the only ones that
across.
Make it. Yeah, they're the only ones that make it in the whole world.
Yeah. Well, there's some German companies that do some of that, too. But all I'm simply saying is that without getting into Caterpillar, China has such a huge demand internally.
Right.
And you and I had this conversation, Scott.
Sure.
China doesn't need to export anything anymore. They have an internal market that is growing like topsy. For those of you who don't know it, the average Chinese worker's wage went up 15%, I think, 3 years ago, 20% last year, and it's going up 20% this year. They've allowed their workers to enjoy a 50% pay increase in 3 years. And we've had the conversation that they're going to go through now with their working class. Let's don't be talking about middle class here.
Right.
Their working class has enjoyed a 50% pay raise on average across the board. That has created a huge demand for things like Walmarts, Kmarts, Home Depots, whatever they call them in China, for fast food restaurants, and for automobiles. And so China has this huge need to put in roads, to build schools, to shopping centers. Their economy is moving from the big cities on the ocean inland now, just like everything was in Detroit, and then it went up to Warren and Oakland County, and then Flint. You guys had the factories in town, and then the counties all the way around you where you have the shopping malls and all this stuff 20, 30 minutes away. They're undergoing that, but not on the scale of a society that had 150 million workers. China has 1.34 billion people.
Yeah.
They have a workforce of around a billion people. So there's a little bit of difference of satisfying the needs of a growing working class among a workforce of 150 million and 750 million.
Yeah.
And they need it now because they're getting the money now. So roads, schools, shopping centers, all that stuff that was all around you folks up there in Flint 15, 20 years ago. You know, every 2 miles is this huge shopping mall. Well, China needs that now. They have these enormous needs for power. They have their own natural resources. They're not like Japan. They've got iron, they've got coal, they've got oil. They've got all that. They're almost self-contained.
But why use theirs if they can use ours up?
Because they're not like us. They're not worried about capitalists, Scott.
Right.
They're not bothered by oil futures traders in China. They're not bothered by keeping technology back so that a company can increase the stock price because the government owns most of the big companies.
Right.
There's no middleman there for them. They know what's out there. This is 1955 in China, in a country that's right up there with the world's leaders in technology. And they're letting these people have these wages because there's a redistribution of wealth going in the reverse now. The 99%, 1% that you see in our society, if you look at an old gold scale, where it was balanced, and this number of people have, this 1% of the people have this much of the wealth, and these 99% of the people have that much of the wealth. What's happening now, and it's actually happening in our society, but it's being accelerated in Asia, is that there's now a redistribution of wealth going on. And the scale is tipping down toward the 99%. And there's more wealth going, transferring from the 1% to the 99%. Let's face it, there's only so many dollars in any given day in any society. And if you take a worker and you increase his pay 50% in 3 years, that's wealth he's getting that he wasn't getting 3 years ago, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what I mean by, let's do it one person at a time. That's a redistribution of wealth. Times 750 million people. And so that's happening in China, and the government has let those guys have that money. They're not playing this game that Caterpillar's playing with its workers right now. They're making so much money at Caterpillar, they don't know what the hell to do with it, yet they want concessions. They want concessions because they can have concessions. Because they can. The Chinese government wants to stay in power. They have this democratic form of socialism over there. And they've made a conscious decision to go ahead and let the wealth be redistributed down to working class people. There is a middle class in China. There are the super rich and there is a middle class. They're a small percentage. Now the Chinese government is letting the working class get richer. So all those people have extra money to spend on extra things. Now you have to make that available to them. And as long as the working class has money, it's that little number in the net box every week, as long as they keep sprinkling overtime on you guys, and that net box gets periodically, there's like, you know, a Christmas present in there. We worked a Saturday or something like that. Okay, fine. No rebellion, so they're just feeding them the money, and now they have to build a country to let them spend it in it. That's because the Chinese government wants to stay in power. And that's going to impact on the rest of us around the world. That's not only going on in China, it's going on in Vietnam, it's going on in Indonesia. They're letting that happen. So their working class is going to very shortly become... Having a car in China is fast coming into the reach of working class people. It's becoming there. Now in our society, we've got a problem because we have 24 million people who can't find a job. In Michigan alone, there are 417,000 unemployed people. 417,000. Out of 3.8 million people. That's not too cool.
No. No. Hell no.
The Case-Shiller company that talks about homes and markets and all that says there's still going to be more homes going into foreclosure. Home ownership is 62% in our society now. At its highest point, it was 67%, but that was about 10 years ago. So that's kind of a funny number, because the population has grown however much it grows over the last 10 years. Wall Street Journal had an article today that people are now renting homes. The guy wrote the article, well, because people are being more efficient in renting. People are renting because it's very difficult to buy a house now, unless you go back into some prime mortgage market. There are some areas in the country where homes are going up, but by and large, homes are still depreciating in price. So as long as we have these 24 million people and growing, my friend Tom told me his daughter graduated from Michigan State University this past Saturday. Take a guess at the number of people who received diplomas on Saturday at Michigan U of M. I'm sorry, at U of M.
I couldn't even guess.
Take a guess at a number. It blew my mind.
3,500.
Okay. You got a number, Don?
I'm going to say just graduated, I'd say 4,700.
11,000.
Whoa. Wasn't even close in the ballpark.
11,000?
I'm just talking about U of M.
Wow.
417,000 people in our state are unemployed out of an overall population of about 3.8 or 3.9 million.
My God.
11,000 came out of one. Of course, U of M's a big school. But that's still a big chunk of people who are walking immediately into the job market in our society, right?
And there isn't one. Right.
Now, the government employment figure said that the number of new employed people was 110,000 people last month. 110,000 people, 10% of them just graduated from U of M. That don't count the people who just got born or graduated high school, does it?
No.
We have a serious what's called demographic problem. And technology is exponentially reducing the need for workers in just about every business in our society on a daily basis.
It sure is.
Now you're talking about that unemployment, and the rate dropped 8.1% last month, and that, you know, and you're talking about the kids getting out of college, but look at all the kids that are even getting out of high school looking for just even a part-time minimum wage job.
Yeah, that's what I just said. I think the BLS said there are approximately 100,000 people a month entering the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
100,000 people.
Crazy.
Every month.
Now, you know, what's kind of surprises me, though, you know, the government only counts people as unemployed if they are actively looking for work. And they're saying that this number is actually, it's actually higher because...
A lot higher.
The percent number, but the actual number. I'm talking about an actual number, Gina.
Right,
24 million.
But they're saying that because more people gave up looking for work. They're saying that people have even stopped looking for work now.
Right, or if your unemployment benefits have ran out, you fall off that number.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the number of people...
Then you're on your own.
Yeah.
Right.
So the number is always going to be larger than what they take and put out there.
Yes.
By a large margin.
Very large margin.
Well, don't mix up, so like I said to Scott, don't mix up the number with the percentage.
No. No, I know what you're saying.
But if you took the real number, then the percentage would change. The percentage would be a lot higher than what they're saying it is. If you took that base number and said, okay, this many people are unemployed, period.
Well, all you got to remember is 100,000 people every month come into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
There was a study done. There were two studies done, and by one set of numbers, it said it would take. They were talking about the 24 million people, and they said, well, it would take about 4 years. And then there was another study that had the more realistic number, and said it'll take 14 years to employ these 24 million existing unemployed workers, and that doesn't count the 100,000 a month that come into the workforce.
Jesus. That's... we got.
But just take our state alone. There's 417,000 people, according to the latest BLS data, state of Michigan, and then they list about 15 cities of how much is unemployed in each city. But just take the state broad brush. Just
right.
Forget the 17,000. There's 400,000 people in Michigan who'd go to work tomorrow if there was a job for them.
Oh, absolutely.
And when these kids graduate this summer from high school in Michigan, however many of those people are coming out of high school are going to add to those 417,000.
And every day we lose jobs because of technology, like you said, every day.
Oh, that new body line they're putting in your plant, I'll guarantee you it's not going to be identical to the one you got.
No.
Unless Mr. Royce is a moron.
I don't believe it is.
Well, you'll probably see less and less people needed in your new body shop.
Oh, yeah. And it's pretty scarce over there now, actually.
Yeah.
And you have an older plant. You don't have, and we had that conversation last week, you don't have a state-of-the-art assembly plant.
Mm-mm.
If you did, you probably would only need two-thirds of the people you have now to run it three shifts, if even two-thirds.
Yeah, they're not even talking paint department now, so you're right.
No, we put that one to bed.
Yeah, that's...
quoted in the paper, I forget where I read it, I told Scott. They're saying they never made an actual commitment to build a new paint shop.
No, just Dana Rose did.
Well, but the GM was pressed. One of the reporters, I don't know if it was the guy from Oakland Press.
Probably
one of the reporters they were talking. I don't know if it was a quarter conference call, but they said there was never a commitment made to build that paint shop. They said we were studying it.
Well, that's not what Amy and Dana had said. Now, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Well, I don't want to get into that. I'm saying they're saying there was never a commitment made to the International Union to do that.
Well, that
was just propaganda during election time. They said what they wanted to.
Right.
Well, I mean, they put a number to it and all that other crap. You know, they made it pretty believable. But then again, Bob King and the International Union had to go along with the lie, didn't they, to the press?
My man, Bob King, there he is again.
Danny, do you send him a Christmas card every year?
Oh, I like to send him something, Jeannie.
Does it come in a brown paper bag and it says, light me?
Oh, my God. That man is... Oh, my, my, my. Don't
give me... Well, look how quiet they've been. They're busy out there now. Bob King has taken over what's left of the Occupy movement with the $60 million in strike fund money.
Yeah.
99%.
And they're training people in all 48 states to be nonviolent protesters.
Yeah.
And they're going out there and protesting every damn thing they can. And when I read this article about Cadillac or Caterpillar, I thought, how come Bob King isn't taking his Gimme 5 Occupy this or whatever the hell he wants to call it down to Peoria at Caterpillar?
That's right. You damn right. Speak it. Oh, hell yeah. That's sorry. And I'm working across from some man making $15 an hour, and he's going around to 99%. Kiss my ass, Bob King, you sorry piece of four-eyed prick bastard son of a...
Now, Danny, just remember, it's still not too late. You can still, if you pull up the website and that, it says right on there, it's still not too late to join up for training for that 99%. You still have a chance to jump on that board.
Get trained and occupy, protest, vent some of that energy you got in hostility.
I'd love to be right on stage with him. Just meet him. And I tell the people what an idiot he is. What a moron.
You know what's interesting? Richard Trumka was on television this morning talking about politics and cap money and supporting the Democrats and all this stuff. And you would think that he never heard of the UAW. There is a schism going on between the UAW and the AFL that's got to be big enough to drive the Titanic.
It's got to be.
King has gone out there. He went against all the labor movements.
That's right.
On that chorus thing, the Korean Trade Act.
He sure did. He's the only one.
He got appointed to that government group where the world trade union leaders are moving. That group that King is a part of is kind of like a subset of Bilderberg, Don.
Yes.
What do you
is.
Think they're meeting about these global trade leaders?
Well, I know.
The suppression of workers and the economic diminishment of workers. What do you think they're meeting about?
That is correct. And they'll be in Chantilly, Virginia on May 29th through June 2nd. Now, if anybody wants to protest, that's where you go, right there at the Marriott in Chantilly, Virginia. And they were there 4 years ago, too, by the way.
Where'd you find that out at?
I got connections, man.
Resources.
I do still study the Bilderberg Group and Carlyle Group. And all the groups I can...
Oh, I thought maybe it was just in a paper or something.
No, it hasn't been announced and it won't be announced, but there's been phone calls. And, you know, Jim Tucker, you can get him on, just Google him. He's been following Bilderberg Group for 36 years.
Okay, but where would I Google to find out about this meeting? Tucker's website?
Probably Jim Tucker's, yeah, and he's going to tell you it's about 99% sure that's where it's going to be. And he might have changed it to 100%.
What's the name of his site?
God, I can't get to
if
it.
If I just Google his name?
Yeah, just Google Jim Tucker it should come right up. People thought he was crazy back in the day because he was a sports reporter and then he was a news reporter and he stumbled onto this Bilderberg Group and nobody heard of them. And he said, it's true. I'm checking them out. And now everybody, pretty much, not everybody, a lot of people still.
Well, there's a lot of it. You can Google the Bilderberg and find pages of stuff.
Well, now you
but,
can.
But I mean, this committee that my interest in what's going on is there was a guy back in the 1920s who came up with this notion of capital and labor, and his notion is that capital will always seek the lowest wage on the planet, but that at some point they're going to run out of planet.
That's right.
And the last place, and I've talked about this, is Africa right now, because we now see that the redistribution of wealth is going on in Asia. There's data out there to be found. The ironic thing is, the redistribution of wealth, like take what's going on at Caterpillar, is still going the wrong way in our society. If the Chinese working class got a 50% raise in 3 years, now there are people who are getting some raises in our society, but these sons of bitches in our society have the unions so castrated now and so co-opted that you get a company like Caterpillar that says, never mind how much money we're making. You know, we're not paying the same money the guy across the street is and all that other stuff.
Right.
Which has nothing to do with a guy who's married and got a couple kids at home who's got to feed his family and go to work.
Absolutely.
They're not interested in that conversation. It's just like, you know, I don't know how Lloyd Roy or Dan Ackerson and Mark Royce can go out and participate in these conference calls and present their first quarter numbers while they know now they have people working in their plant. Let's take a tier two who is a tier two,
right,
who has to have a second full-time job in order to survive. If that's the cost of a car, we don't need them. If that's the cost of a car, and then they want to take a car like the Sonic, which might have been a people's car, and
I
turn
thought...
it into a Martha Stewart home decorated version.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, when they came out with the Sonic, I said, oh, they're going to make something that lower income people can just jump.
A people's car. Yeah,
yeah,
a people's car.
And, my God, I can't believe the price they want for that thing. And then if you just want anything at all in a damn thing, you're paying some money. You're paying some big money. Now, it surprised me. But then again, it didn't surprise me because it seems like the old GM is like the new, or new GM is like the old GM.
I don't understand Ackerson. Why didn't they just take that Sonic, put a $17,500 price tag on it, make one damn model like they did
right.
the Volkswagen. I bought a Volkswagen in 1971.
Love it.
Walked into the dealership at 8 Mile and Gratiot. Here was this black thing. I looked at it. I looked at the window sticker price. It was $1,300 and some dollars. I looked at it, and I slammed the door. I banged the fender. Jesus, there was more metal in that fender than any three
right.
Chevrolets.
That's right.
And when I went to close the door, the windows were closed. The air pressure pushed back on me. So I go into the salesman's office. I says, well, I said, you know what? I said, I want to buy one of these things. And he says, okay, fine. I said, okay, so how much is the car? And he said, you didn't really look at the car? I said, of course I looked at the car. He said, did you look at the sticker price on the window? He said, yeah. He said, that's the car, Dick. The price on the window is what we sell it for. And by the way, you can only buy one thing that ain't on that car. We have nothing that we can sell you that ain't on our car but one thing, and we can put a propane heater under the hood of the trunk because the trunk was in the front of the car.
Right.
If you want it, but I'm telling you, you don't need it. I said, what are you telling me? And by the way, they all came in black. In 1961. Shays of Henry Ford. And I said, that's it. He said, that's the price of the car, Dick. I said, what? I said, Jesus Christ, why doesn't General Motors do this? Why the hell don't they do this? They sold them damn Volkswagens, Don, by the bucketful.
Yeah.
61, 62, 63, they sold them cars by the bucketful.
Yes, they
and
did.
And they were everything that Volkswagen said they were. All right, let's come forward to 2012. The Sonic obviously is not as durable a car as a 1961 Volkswagen. There's no way. But never mind that. I saw one. I stopped 3 weeks ago up at the corner gas station, there was a Shell, and there was this black thing, and I looked at that, geez, what is that? And it was a Sonic. It was a black four-door base model Sonic. I looked at that thing, and I thought, I can get this much car for $17,000? And I called my friend Tom Hopp up, who's a team leader over at Orion. I said, I saw one of your beasties. I said, you know what? That's a lot of car for that kind of money. He said, yeah. Yeah, if it's all right. I mean, you know, because they got so much problems in the plant. And I thought, I said, you know, Tom, why don't they do what, like when I bought my 61 Volkswagen? Slap that son of a bitch in a dealership and say $17,499 and you're out of here.
Yeah.
And maybe put that other $1,000 or $2,000 worth of options that cost General Motors $50 to put on the car in the car.
Right.
I'm telling you where Scott was saying, oh, Sonic, I'm telling you I believe those Sonic numbers would go through the roof.
I think you're right.
And you don't have to advertise it, by the way, because it would be a good buy. Word of mouth will sell that. You don't need a big advertising budget.
No.
Instead, they're doing all these advertising budgets, showing these cars that look like something out of a Japanese nerd movie, flames and spots all over them and all this crap. Who are these cars for? You know who the main buyer of those Sonics are? Retired people.
Yeah, I believe that.
In 2000, the 18 to 35 old buyers comprise 24% of the purchase cars. In 2012, the 18 to 35 buyers comprise only 12%.
That's some.
And the people who are 55 and over have gone from 54% to 67% of purchasing cars. The people in the middle are not buying more cars. It's older people. And when we all die, there ain't going to be any of us to buy these cars. Because that guy with $16 an hour, or 3 years from now with $20 an hour, ain't buying that car.
No,
because that $18,000 Sonic is going to be $22,000 without the wheels in 2014.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's going to be probably no less than in 2014. I'm going to say that the workforce in GM plants will be somewhere between 10 and 15% less the per capita headcount. And
yeah,
that they'll be selling, well, if General Motors even only maintains its market share now.
If we're in business.
Then
right,
they'll do 1.5 million, maybe 1.6 million cars in a year. Although I don't know that General Motors, out in that playing field with all those players out there, I don't know what kind of market share they're going to have even this year.
No.
It doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't look good at all. And that's what you got to look at. And they can
I want to see Mr. Royce get up there and say, we increased our market share 2% this year. We increased our market share 2% this year. We increased our market share 2% this year. I don't care nothing about his EBITDA dollars.
Right.
Sooner or later, the market is going to get so big. They're talking 13.2, maybe 14 this year, maybe. I think they're wrong. I think they're running out of the people who can afford to buy cars. And I think the real predictor of what's going on is General Motors and their subprime. 8.6% of their sales were subprime sales.
It is, yeah.
Just the first quarter, Don.
That's crazy. It's freaking crazy.
So if you carry that out for three more quarters, then you could say that 24% of the cars they sold were subprime. By the time they publish the end of the year statement, what, 20 to 24% are going to be subprime loans?
Right. Yeah. Sure as hell seems like it. That's what's happening. I don't know where Scott Shingledecker dropped off. You want to call back in, Scott? We hope you do. And Cindy, give me some damn coffee. There you go.
Say please.
Please.
There you go.
Over here, dying over here. Yeah. Jeannie, you had a daughter just graduated.
Yes. Well, she's graduating. Actually, the next union meeting on the 20th. It's going to be the first one I've missed in a long time, but she actually, that's her graduation that day, so I'm definitely going to the graduation, not the union meeting. But she had her prom last night.
Well, very good.
And, yep, and I was so excited for her, but, you know, it's pretty sad because that's my baby girl, and I've been, you know, I've had a kid underneath my roof for 26 years, but she's been working since she was 16, and so she already has a job when she gets out of high school, and she's going to continue on, take some college courses at the same time.
Oh, that's good.
Yep.
Well, good, because, you know, keep your jobs. For God's sake, you give
them. Oh, yeah.
Keep it.
The way the economy is anymore, you know, with four kids and that stuff, my kids have paid for 100% of their college, and my oldest daughter, she's already graduated college, cum laude, and she paid for 100% of her college all by herself while working two jobs.
Did she start out in a community college?
Yeah, she went to SC Ford at St. Clair
County.
That's
the best way for these kids today is go to a community college.
It is.
Because the tuition is cheaper, and then let them spend 2 years there. And at the end of those 2 years, then they'll pretty much have had enough of that under their belt to figure out what they want to do with their life.
Well, my youngest boy, he actually went on to play football at one of the colleges. And
okay.
He was doing good, you know, and I thoroughly enjoyed watching him play football. And he did great first year. The second year, he says, you know, Mom, he says, by the time I graduate college, I'm going to owe all this money back. He says, I really want to play football, but he says, I'm thinking I'm going to go to a community college. So he transferred over. Now he's going to university in that, but at Saginaw Valley. But he got away from the football just because he foreseen the future in that stuff of having to pay back all those college loans when he was done.
College loans are in our society, just within North America now, in America.
Yeah.
Like the credit default swaps busted an economic bubble, these college loans are going to bust an economic bubble, I'm telling you.
They are.
They are.
There's no way with even if kids don't have a hard science degree or a professional degree, and most of them don't, the price of these tuitions, what is it? $20,000 a year minimum. If you went to a Michigan State or U of M,
I don't know, Eagle.
You're going to get out of college owing $80,000 to $100,000 4 years from now.
Yeah.
And wages aren't getting any bigger in our society. They're either holding fast or getting smaller.
Correct.
How the hell does a kid pay $100,000 back?
Well, they can.
What a tough nut that is.
Well,
my oldest son won't file bankruptcy.
No, you can't do that on loans.
But my oldest son, he started off at a community college, transferred a second year to university, and he's like, this is ridiculous. He's like, these teachers here at the university are actually worse than the ones I had at the community college. So this year he's gone back to the community college.
Sure.
And that, because both my boys at the universities, including the private one, okay, check this out. They had a professor whose primary language was German, who spoke English, teaching Chinese.
Okay.
So he primarily spoke German. Second language was American English. Teaching Chinese.
Okay.
So, and he said that was the most difficult way to try to learn a language out of anything. He was like, forget it. That was ridiculous.
I feel that whether somebody goes to, and by the way, I'm just going to preempt this conversation with this remark. These prestigious colleges, Harvard, Yale, Case Western in Chicago, University of Pittsburgh, all these prestigious business schools, this whole house of cards on getting an MBA is falling apart. If you went to Harvard and you wanted to get just an MBA, that could cost you $50,000. Just an MBA. But the problem with the teaching is that MBAs teach witchcraft. All the colleges teach different courses for you to get to be an MBA. And the businesses now are finding that these kids from these prestigious schools who graduate with A averages that have Masters of Business Administration come in and they don't have anything of value to offer the company. So having said that, I'm saying you're going to start reading about that this whole MBA industry that these colleges are running is starting to get raggedy around the edges now. On the other hand, I feel this way, that a kid, if he's 18, if they do know what they want to be, even if they don't know what they want to be, let him go to community college for 2 years. Let him go on to a cheaper college somewhere else and get their 4-year undergraduate degree. I view a college education as just the key to a door. And I think if a person has just intrinsic, innate abilities and skills, it's not going to matter what college they went to. I think that whole ego thing of, well, if you got a degree from Harvard, your future's made, I don't think that exists anymore in our society. I really don't.
I agree with you.
I just think that let that kid go get a college degree wherever it's cheapest to get. That at least gets him the interview.
Yep.
And these personnel people who are interviewing and a test they have, if your kid's got something to offer, they're going to hire him. And I ain't talking about what he learned in the school.
No. Scott, you're back on.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry about that. I don't want to interrupt with what happened, but I got to share the story with you a little bit. I just had somebody come down here who wanted to thank me for helping him out Saturday night. He came into work, and he's got 99 seniority,
mm-hmm.
95 seniority. Anyway, he came from one of the Delphi plants. Yeah, and he came in 99, he came to our plant. And you're going to love this one. He's been trying, get this, trying to get his wife added on to his insurance for 2 years.
For 2 years?
For 2 years.
Jesus.
He come in Saturday, and he was frazzled. I mean, he was shaken. He was pissed. I took him off the side. I got him calmed down. He couldn't even go talk to the foreman. He was so pissed. I says, you want me to go talk to him? He says, please. I went in. I told my foreman, this gentleman needs, one, a benefits call, two, a committee call, and three, he needs to see if you will find out if there's somebody here from labor relations, period. And we know what it was about. And I says, this is what's happening. He goes, well, benefits call. I said, no, he needs his committee man, and he said he needs to talk to his employer, who is the labor rep right now. I says, that's who's going to take care of this for him.
Who's he been talking to? Union people?
Yep.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
So.
For 2 years?
So he went, well, they tell him he's fine. Somebody say, okay, you've got it now. She's on your plan. Well, something happens to his wife. She goes to the doctor. They say, you're denied. You don't have no insurance.
And this is a union person telling him that.
Yes. So, make a long story short, he got to go down to labor relations Saturday. On top of the job that he's doing, they've made his job as pure hell. They're supposed to add another person on that job. They didn't do it. They're having one person do it. He was just completely frazzled. They ended up getting the committeeman then down there at labor relations. He went home early Saturday night. He came home, or he left out of there probably about 5:30, quarter to 6. He come and got his stuff and went home. But his wife's back went out, and she's on the couch at home. He come down here to my house, so I had to leave, to thank me for helping him. And
did he get her on the insurance?
Who is the
Duncan?
Not the main guy for labor, but the next guy down from him. Not months, but the other
Romanowski?
Guy. That guy.
Romanowski
was there. Romanowski said Monday, they will have an answer as to why.
Wow.
And hopefully there'll be a finale.
But Romanowski didn't say, okay, I'm putting your wife on your insurance plan. He just said, I'm going to find out why.
Yeah.
Right. We have 90 seconds left. Anybody like to call in, do it now. And we'll probably go over like we do every Sunday night for a little while. So if you want to join in, please call now. And if not, thank you very much for showing up tonight. We'll be back next Sunday night at 6 p.m. There you go. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No. It's just one, it amazes me. I didn't know that he was having this problem. And I says, why didn't you tell me this sooner? And he says, well, I didn't think about it because his wife, for all practical purposes, is healthy. And it just... Friday night, she threw her back out, and Saturday, and they've got two small kids at home.
Mm-hmm. And he's trying to take care of her and the kids. And, you know, so at least I got him pointing the right direction. He got some answers this time.
He got Romanowski to say, I'll try and get an answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I asked
wrote a letter to Dan Ackerson.
Yeah. Well, I asked him point blank. I says, have you talked to Fred? And he says, no.
Well.
And I says, you need to talk with Fred. I says, because Fred will definitely get you an answer.
Who's Fred?
Fred Wright. He's union.
In charge of benefits.
They got nothing to do with this.
Well, I know, but he would get an answer. I'm telling you, he's the best.
Okay.
Well, Fred's not. Fred does his job the way he is supposed to do his job and then goes the extra mile for the people. He's not one of the normal people.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
He's not one of the typicals.
How much seniority has this guy got with the corporation all told?
Oh, Fred's got to have over 30 years.
No, this
is... No, your friend. 99, didn't you say?
I think he's got 95.
Okay, 95.
Because so he's a legacy worker.
Yeah, he's a legacy worker. He came
and
in,
he don't
he
have insurance? And he's all
got
his time, he hasn't had insurance?
Wow.
He's got insurance. Get this. He's got insurance. His kids have insurance through him. They're on his policy. But his wife isn't on the policy. He's been fighting to get his wife on the policy.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy.
So, but to make a long story short, he thought he had this whole thing resolved was back in, this is May. It was last fall, I think he said last September. He went through this. They came out and they told him, you're good to go. His wife's back went out Friday. He went to take her, Friday night. He went to take her to the emergency room. They said, she don't have no insurance.
Well, that happened to me once, and actually fairly recently because I got remarried, and Frank went to go use insurance, and they said he wasn't on there. So what I did, I just called the number on the back of my Blue Cross Blue Shield card. They got it all straightened out. Hmm. I didn't even have to go to management or labor or union or anybody. I just talked directly to Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they got it straightened out. For some reason, there was some kind of, I don't know, glitch or something, but they got it all straightened out.
Yeah, there must be some anomaly here. When he came to Flint, that the way the data got mixed up.
Well,
but
no,
I mean,
because he got married after he got here at Flint.
Oh, he got married after he came. Oh, there you go. So he came to Flint. Now, are those kids his kids?
Yes, they are.
Okay, so he came there with his two kids, got his Blue Cross. Now he married a woman, and he wants to put her on his insurance because she's his wife.
All I need to do
but
is call
the
number on the back of his Blue Cross Blue Shield card.
I think he's got Health Plus, so same number or same kind
of
concept.
All he had to do was call the number on the card.
Mm-hmm. That's all I had to do.
Right. Well, I guess when all comes down to it, when it deals with any part of your pension, your pay, or your benefits,
stay away from the UAW like they
got
the plague.
You go to your employer.
Employer.
Period.
In the case of the insurance, I mean, they tell you right on the card, if you have any problems, call us. He never did that.
Right. I don't know what he did or did not do as far as that. All I know is he was in a bad way, and I just tried to give him the best direction I could.
Good.
That's why you should be, anyway. I won't even go into that. There you go.
And that's what he said, too.
another example that you would have got from other people.
Yeah.
You do like Dick does. You go that extra mile to help people, and Dick, and you've been putting up with me, and I'm clueless on a lot of this stuff, and you've been very patient with me, and I appreciate both of you, especially.
Well, but it's real easy now. You have to learn anything about the UAW except stay away from them. That's the first lesson.
That's my first lesson. Stay
there. Just, all you have to remember is one simple fact. You don't work for the UAW.
No.
You work for the corporation. And the corporation has a legal obligation to you as your
employer. Yes.
And I'll even contractually make the case for staying away from the UAW. Paragraph 28 of the National Agreement.
Management shall first be given the opportunity to
It says that you have a choice not to go to the union. Paragraph 28 says exactly what 29 says with one difference. It says an employee or any group of employee who have a problem may first go to their supervisor. Let's call that management. Because I wouldn't screw around with my supervisor, but it's still codified in a language. You have a right to not use the union when you have any problem. That's paragraph 28. 29 says the same thing except may put in a call for the committee man, and there'll be no further discussion.
Right.
But even though paragraph 28 is there, one of the things that I've talked with Scott about is the hell with all that stuff that anything the UAW had anything to do with, like a contract. Go to your employer. You work for them, they hired you, they can fire you, they pay you. Forget the contract. Forget you're in a union. It's the company that provides you with these things. I don't care if it's because a contract was notified. It's still the company that's doing it. If there was no UAW, then let's just say you're going to have the health care anyhow.
Right.
If they want to give you a pension, you'll have a pension, with or without a UAW. So, there's a book I've got here that's 30 years old called Employees' Rights in a Corporation. And there's another book about management's obligations to employees. So your legal contract has nothing to do with the damn UAW. Your employment contract is with the corporation and everything attached to that. And one of those things attached to it is something called remuneration. Remuneration is the all-encompassing words for all those things that you get in exchange for your labor. Pensions, holidays, wages, insurance, health insurance, life insurance, all that is part of your remuneration package. And it has nothing to do with the damn, whether they negotiated a contract or not, it's still a company that's providing it to you. There's really no reason to deal with all this nonsense. There was a reason probably 20 years ago because the union took all these responsibilities to heart. But the last guy you ever want to talk to about anything but writing a grievance is the committee man. You never want to talk to the committee man about your benefits or anything like that. And if the benefit rep, now you got a guy named Fred, and you say, well, you know, Fred really will try and help people. But the reality of life is you got a Blue Cross card, it's got a number on the back, as Jeannie said, call it. The committee man, the benefit rep have nothing to do with that. Neither does Mike Muntz, the personnel director. You have insurance coverage with that provider. And if you say, look, I got married, my wife's not out on my card. Okay, send us a copy of your marriage license.
Right. I know
you
got to
feel sorry for this guy because people are so confused in the plan. They're so confused about who am I supposed to go to. Oh, I guess I'm supposed to go to the committee man because he says he's the personal assistant to God for everything.
Right.
Well, he's not.
Right. Well, it's like this. When people realize when you get hired from General Motors, I'm just going to use that for our example. When I signed my contract with General Motors, they agreed to take care of a pension for me. They agreed to take care of my my benefit.
Provide.
You're right. Provide me a pension. Provide me with a benefits package. And I agreed to come to work every day. They agreed to pay me. Everything else in between there was negotiable. But when I signed that contract with them,
That was a legal binding contract, and they agreed that they were going to take care of, provide me a pension and provide me with health care. It's that simple. UAW wasn't on there
anywhere. The interesting thing is, you don't get a pension check from the UAW. The pension check doesn't say GM UAW.
No, it does not.
And the company has a legal relationship with you on your pension. If you don't believe that, read ERISA.
Right.
Oh, no rest
of
the union under ERISA.
Hey, Don, here's some
yes.
good news for you.
Okay.
Ron Paul just took 22 out of 25 delegates in Nevada.
Yes. Hello.
Okay. Just to let you know.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. But anyway, sorry about that. I had to interrupt because I know that
breaking
you'd
news.
Like to hear that. Breaking news. There you go.
Oh, God, where's Ross Perot? Come on, Ross. Come on out there and take this president's job.
I like Ross
Jesus.
Perot.
I think Perot would have done a good job. The only thing is he backed down, and then when he stepped back in, I think he lost a lot of credibility with people.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't let him into the debates, though.
Exactly.
I mean, the fundamental thing that has to change, was it yesterday? I watched one of the public television things out in Nevada. They had a Libertarians convention.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was Saturday, and I was really busy doing a lot of things, and I just happened to leave the TV on while I'm crashing around doing some other things, and people were calling. And so in between, I'm seeing these nominations I'm seeing these speeches for candidates for president and vice president, and I'm seeing then the delegates casting their votes and then reading out who they're endorsing.
Right.
And I saw one place where most states won't let the libertarians on the ballot.
Well, they don't want a three-party system. No.
And this one guy who was running for vice president said that he changed his name. He took his name like Joe Smith, and he added another last name called Joe Smith Libertarian. And that way he got on a ballot with the Libertarian behind his name.
God. That's
but I mean, in our society where we have all this democracy, I'm listening to these guys say we can't even get on the ballot in these states.
It's terrible.
I mean, that's insane. And then they were recapping, or maybe it was another show where you have to have 24%, what is it, 24% of something to get in debates.
Yeah, they change those rules depending on, as they go along, actually. CNN definitely did. They changed the rules. And 4 years ago, they changed the rules on Ron Paul. But they can't do that anymore because he's winning some states. He won the early states, and they didn't want to give it to
him.
Yeah,
but if you're a legitimate candidate from a party, I don't care how big or small it is, everybody should participate in a debate.
Well, I agree. I'm not arguing with you.
I know you're not.
They're
I'm just saying.
Stinking law.
It's so bullshit.
It is. It's terrible. People, American people eat that crap up, and they don't see what's happening. John Huntsman, they wouldn't let him on at CNN because he only had 2%. So what? Let him in. I want to know his views.
because we're slaves, and they're the masters, and then they give you this false sense that you have
That's
the choice.
Right. That's right.
It's they give you a choice that you think you have this freedom to choose. You don't. They own everything. Remember, like Carlin said, they own everything.
That's right.
So, you know, the same thing with the union.
I understand that. I'm just saying that our societies, we become, you know, when Obama says, well, I just killed Osama bin Laden, democracy at work.
Yeah.
And the world envies us. They want our democratic system. I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
I agree. I wouldn't give it to nobody. Oh, my God.
Give it to the people you dislike.
I mean, this election is going to be something. Oh, yes. This election for president is going to be something. Not in terms of who's going to win or lose.
No.
This election is going to institutionalize a single political entity in Washington. What you've seen going on so far, do nothing. You know, we're against you. We're not going to pass this. We're not going to pass that. Mm-hmm. I think this election, plus the economic problems in our society, whoever the hell gets elected, the reality of our society is not going to go away. And these people, as operating as one party, have fundamentally changed the economics of our society, Don.
They sure have.
They are now saying a $1.4 trillion budget is livable for each of the coming 9 years. That changes the economic structure of our society.
In a big way.
They're now saying we can overspend $1.4 trillion a year, and life goes on. And that money is going to amalgamate the Democrats and Republicans into one unit.
One unit.
Because at some point after this election, they're going to have to still do the business of the government. Only they're going to do it as one on borrowed money. They are going to be co-conspirators while they are on their way to bankrupting the society.
Well, I think they are now, but I think it's going to be cemented in the next 4 years. I think they're co-conspirators now.
Well, as soon as the election is over, though, they're going to have to do a budget. They're going to have to get on with whatever they're going to do in Afghanistan. I mean, Obama runs over there and says we're going to be there till 2024.
14.
I mean, I'm sitting here. This guy is saying we're in a war, and it's going to go on from 2012 to 2024. I'm 76 and a half years old. I'll be dead before that war is over.
Yeah. What are we fighting for, people? Has anybody asked themselves?
We're there because we're training the Army to be self-sufficient.
We
had this conversation. My boot camp was 12 weeks.
Thank you.
My combat training was 6 weeks.
Thank you.
They put me on a boat, put a BAR in my hand, and said, go to war.
Amen.
And we've been training their damn Army for 10 years, and they don't know how to fight a war.
Yeah. No argument here, my friend. No, right.
The people in our society, because they ended the draft because they're afraid of people taking to the streets.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they're controlling society.
That's right.
The only thing that will ever bring this society into the streets is the draft. Nothing will bring the society from New York to San Francisco into the street but a draft.
That's right. And I agree 100%. That's why
they had all that shit around Kent University and draft dodgers, and it was all about that draft. And those people in Washington said, if we have to sell our children, we're not doing a draft.
That's right. That happened 42 years ago, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah, that was yesterday, I think, was the anniversary.
And now we're going to be in a war for 24 years? How crazy can we all get here? He signs a piece of paper and it says, we're going to be here for 12 more years. People are going to die. Oh, by the way, I saw a piece in a Washington Post. They're closing down the American embassy in Afghanistan because it's unsafe.
It's unsafe.
Imagine that.
They built an $80 million embassy.
Like they did in...
And now they're walking away from it because they said it's unsafe.
That's incredible.
$80 million for an embassy.
Yeah.
It's unsafe.
They say, I don't know if it's that one or the one in Iraq is bigger than any, all the embassies put together.
The one in Iraq is.
Yeah.
Well, that's because you got two million barrels of oil per day minimum
mm-hmm.
coming out of there.
And we still have some soldiers stationed over there in there right along.
Forever, as long as the oil's coming out of the ground.
Exactly. Exactly.
As long as the oil's coming out of the ground.
We're creating our treasury and our people, our young people's lives for oil.
By the way, they got a new car engine.
Uh-oh.
It's a steam generator that burns anything. Anything. Its exhaust is vapor. And there's a company, it starts with a C. Is it a Clayton engine? Anyhow, they got a full-size running one of these things.
Yes.
And they're going to put it in a land speed record car. They've got the car built. They're going to put this engine in it.
Wow.
I know what you're talking about. And I think they make it down by Detroit.
I think what this thing does, I'm not sure because I didn't read the whole article. I think what this thing does is it drives in electric motors.
Yeah.
Like the EV1.
Yeah.
So instead of having a battery pack
it runs
with a
on
motor
steam.
On each wheel, you have this thing. It's circular. And it's on Truth About Cars, Scott.
Yeah.
And they got all the parts of a standard combustion engine laid out on one picture, and they got all the parts of this thing broken down, laid out on another. And it spins around like a centrifuge. And it burns anything. Garbage, whatever. And it creates power out of whatever you put into it. And I really didn't read all the stuff about it. But they've already built the car this engine's going to go into. And I'm going to set a land speed record with it.
Well, I hope so. And just watch one of the big companies buy them out and offer them
or put them out of business.
And then put them out of business, and that's the last you'll hear of it.
I really don't think it's anything more than an EV1, only instead of a battery pack, you got this engine that creates the electricity. Through alternators or generators. I'm not sure how that would be. Well, actually, the most efficient would be direct current, not
right.
alternating current. So if it's direct current, you'd have a generator creating
right.
electricity. There's no transmission in this car.
No transmission. Wow.
No transmission. There's
no
conversions of. There's no conversion of fuel to mechanical energy. I believe there's an electric motor on each of the wheels on the car. But there's no transmission.
That's amazing.
Just
right.
Well, that's what the EV1 had a motor on each of the four wheels done.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, that's why the car was so great. There was no conversion of electrical to mechanical energy. You had the electric motor on each of the four wheels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the secret to an electric car. And this land speed record thing has got no transmission whatsoever. You got this thing like a steam engine. You know, a steam engine generated the paddle wheel on the riverboats, right?
Right. Right.
Okay. So that's what's going on here. It turns the creator of the electrical energy to feed the wheels. And that's it. You take your hand control, you take your hand off it, the wheels simply stop turning.
God, be damned.
So, and that's why they smashed the EV1s down. It was too perfect.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
You take the batteries they had in the EV1 and put today's Lion batteries in it. And
wow.
It would be even more perfect.
And
there's nothing else underneath that car. There's no...
Right.
Just the motors that drive the wheels and the electrical current to them.
And they say, we're working on building an all-electric car. Why? You already had one. You guys know how to do
well,
it.
Well, you want to go to Truth About Cars, Scott, and or
right.
John. You can and look at the piece on this engine, and there's another piece on electric cars, and what a scam it's been. And there's a study that was done by a company that's embedded in this thing about the so-called electric cars we have, the hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who wrote the article, I believe it was me, says it's nothing but a scam. And now General Motors has made seven, remember the GM Spark, which would be like the GM
right.
Metro?
Right.
They now are road testing an electric GM Spark. And the reason they have to do that is, once again, California. And the only reason they put all... Now, this is the typical waste of money is what I'm talking about. They're making these Sparks so they can put them in California because California's got those average fuel emission things.
Mm-hmm.
So you need something like a Spark that is tiny and it's electric and doesn't emit anything so you can put a Corvette next to it. Okay? And on Truth About Cars, Scott, they've got a picture of three of these things in a row. I think it shows a picture of 5, 6, and 7 in the back window. And they're
mm-hmm.
Chevrolet Sparks. And this guy's saying the only reason they're building these is for fleet fuel mile average. Now, this is a total waste of money, my friends.
Jesus. Is that why they're building them?
Yes, it's right in the article.
Damn.
You're not going to drive that thing in Michigan when it's snowing.
No.
It's too small.
What a scam.
So you got California that's got the fuel emission standards. So that they're billing them for California. Or maybe even out west. But the thing is so small. But they're putting all this money. And by the way, it's the battery for the electric Spark that blew up at the tech center. That's in
not
the
Volt.
No. It's a 1-2-3 battery, but it's different. And and Truth About Cars found out that it was the battery for the Spark that blew up at the tech center. So how much is that costing?
Jesus.
Just to tell a lie that our average fuel cafe standard is met. I mean, the government should stop that shit with average fleet fuel. You still got GM vehicles and Chrysler and Ford vehicles that are somewhere between 12 and 14 miles a gallon.
Yeah. Your average
haven't done anything to improve that the mileage on the big vehicles.
Your average Jeep Wrangler with a four-cylinder is 14 to 16. That's your average. 14 city, 16 on the highway.
Yeah.
With a four-cylinder. It's a big
but
four-cylinder.
But you guys got to look at the Truth About Cars site tonight and look
I'll
at the one
that.
On that. It's a Clayton engine, I think. And look at the article on the electric vehicles and what a sham this is just being perpetrated on the American public with these hybrid cars.
Yeah, don't surprise me.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, Scott, again, second 100-year apprenticeship. Does General Motors really have the money for that?
Right.
Why not take that money and make a Chevrolet Sonic that costs $18,000 out the door, that's got an air conditioner, that's got decent tires, that's got an interior, and say, we have the people's car, line up outside the dealership?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all about what they choose to do with their resources.
Right.
I mean, don't forget, there are no new cars in GM. Everything's an Opel, 20-year-old platforms.
Right.
Yeah. My idea.
They're destroying the Cadillac brand. They're literally destroying the brand, if not destroyed it. Cadillac sales are down on their... Full-size Cadillac are down 16%.
Why in
the first quarter?
Nah.
What Cadillac do you want? You want a regular size, a medium size, or the kiddie car size? We got all three sizes of Cadillac now.
That's crazy. You know, that is...
They are destroying the brand.
Yes, they are.
Ford is trying to bring back the Lincoln. What do? They take a Ford Fusion and turn it into a Lincoln. That's not a Lincoln.
That's not a Lincoln at all. Yeah.
Cadillacs are Cruzas and Malibus and probably Sonic platforms.
God damn.
Yeah. And these Asian companies are kicking our royal asses with their cars.
They're
making them bigger.
Our people.
They're making them bigger. They're putting more in them.
Yep.
And now Marchionne, even though the sweat and toil of the Chrysler UAW workers is raising all ships between Fiat and Chrysler, and Fiat's got the deal out of the bankruptcy where they can force the Viva to sell them 3.2% more of the stock that the Viva owns. And what's going on now, little known story, the reason that it's a problem right now is they can't come to terms on the price with the Viva.
Man.
Jeez. And Fiat has announced unashamedly, we want to own 100% of this company, and we will in the end.
Yeah, I believe they will. You're right.
Hang on.
And it's Obama coming. Gave Chrysler to Fiat for no money, don't forget.
Yes.
In the bankruptcy.
Just
you
gave,
should get such a deal.
Yeah, just gave it away.
That's right.
Amazing.
And we bought Fiat, or we put $2 billion into Fiat,
mm-hmm.
and it
yeah.
turned out to be such a fiasco, we had to give them another $2 billion to let us walk
get
away.
Out. Yep.
God.
American business management at its finest.
Jeez. Man.
I tell you, these people who run Ford, GM, and Chrysler, I would tell you what, this guy Marchionne, they ought to do what they used to do with the Indian Maharajas back in the days of colonialism. Once a year, the Maharaja would sit on one side of a scale, and they'd load the other side of the scale up with jewels. When the scale was balanced, that's what they gave him.
There you go.
And that's what they ought to do to Marchionne. This guy is kicking some real ass in this American market. And the new platforms he's bringing in from Fiat
mm-hmm.
are really going to be something.
Yeah, I believe
yeah.
I believe he's the man. Yeah. No question.
However, he's a heartless bastard when it comes to his workers. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
You don't hear him talking about fair wages or any of this shit.
No.
He just says, this is what I got to have now.
Right.
That's
you three lay down in front of the bus today, and on Friday, you three lay down in front of the bus.
You're right.
You don't hear any of this sentiment coming out of his mouth.
No. No, you don't. And I, you know, I'd seen the article the other day about the head of General Motors crying that he needs to get more money so he can pay his people right.
The salary people.
Yeah, the salary.
Yeah.
We're losing them. Well, Christ, might as well lose them. As far as I'm concerned, they're not doing a damn thing. They're doing the same thing we've done. Like
they're
you
not
said,
losing
Dick,
them, they're Robert. Laying them. Don, Jeannie just told you, they're laying them off. They're laying off some of their best and brightest people. They're laying off their creative and innovative people.
Yeah.
They're engineers. What, you need money for the MBAs? For the bookkeepers?
I don't know what he needs money for.
What cars do they build?
Zero.
What the hell is General Motors going to have to bring to market 2 years from now? What is new that they're doing? I can't find it anywhere in the press.
I don't know what they're doing. All I know is about the truck, and that's all I know. And
but
I don't know.
That's not that different.
It's
not that different.
It's just going to be bigger, and that's about all I know.
Well, when you say bigger, not
yeah.
on the inside, on the outside.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we had this discussion last week. You're right.
And don't forget, I don't know if I tell you this story. We were having our Monday meeting during the product launch when we were developing the car, and we'd meet every Monday morning, and the five people would come in and make their presentations, and the guy from Interior Systems came in, and one of the remarks he made, he says, we've increased the interior room in the car. And Skip LaFoe, who was the president of the company, said, how did you do that? He said, we made the knobs smaller on the dashboard. Honest story.
Wow.
They count those cubic inches of space in the car. If you make a knob smaller, you've made the interior bigger. It's like General Motors saying, we're going to create or maintain 6,000 jobs over the life of the agreement. By the way, guys, we didn't tell you we were going to hire anybody.
Right.
We're going to increase the interior space in the car. We're going to make the seats thinner. We're going to make the knobs smaller. I mean, they're still doing these kinds of things. This is not the way to be in this business. When you're making a tangible part. And moreover, the largest purchase that most people are going to be making in their life between now and 2014 is going to be cars, not houses.
True.
And the sad part of this, on a subprime loan, and we had this conversation, cars ain't made to last 50 years.
No.
So you give me a subprime loan on a $36,000 car. Me and my wife both make $35,000 or $16 an hour. That's the biggest purchase we're going to make in a long time because you're giving me a 60-month finance deal.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
Fellas, it's 8:30, and I got to let you go so I
can
go rattle my kids.
Oh, God, you're right. It's 8:36.
Yep, I think that's about the same thing here. I got a few things I got to do before I get ready to go to work tomorrow.
All right, guys. Everybody have a good week, and I'll try and get down to see you if I can. Sometime this week.
I'd like to talk to you.
All right,
good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. And Jeannie, I'm off tomorrow, so.
Well, enjoy your day off.
I will. You take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Good night, Dick. Good night, Danny.
Tell Frank I said hello.
Sure will.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye.